Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today are Semantic Threat Researchers Alan Neville and Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be discussing a new and interesting ransomware family that has just been discovered and APT attacks against a string of telecoms firms in the Middle East and Asia. But first, let's turn to what's turned out to be the cybersecurity story of the week, if not the month. That's because on Thursday, December 9th, Apache revealed that a critical vulnerability had been found in its Log4j software. Exploit code quickly became publicly available, and it triggered a huge rush on Friday and on into the weekend by organizations who use Log4j to patch the vulnerability. News headlines dubbed the discovery as catastrophic and the most serious vulnerability since Heartbleed. So here to talk about the vulnerability is Alan from our Threat Hunter team, who spent a lot of time over the past week working on our response to this incident. So I guess, Alan, let's start at the start, because I think before this thing blew up, not a lot of people knew what Log4j was unless they were kind of, you know, specifically involved with it. So what is it exactly?
Yeah, so Log4j is essentially an open source Java-based library that's owned by the Apache Software Foundation. And just it's one of several logging frameworks owned by the group. Essentially, it allows developers to add customized logging capabilities to their applications and services, and it's used by thousands, if not millions, of applications, including those used by some of the biggest well-known enterprises in the world.
Okay, let's talk about the vulnerability itself. What was the vulnerability, and I guess why was it considered so serious?
So it's kind of funny, just the other day I read an analogy or came across an analogy that someone had used to describe what this vulnerability was all about. And it was essentially this: they were put it towards, imagine there's like a standard bolt that's used in essentially every car manufacturer in the world. Well, they've just discovered that the bolt is faulty and needs to be replaced to ensure the safety of everyone driving all the cars. But in reality, the vulnerability, which is also known as CV-2021-44228, or has been dubbed Log4Shell, is a remote code execution vulnerability. And this allows an unauthenticated attacker to gain complete access to vulnerable systems. I suppose this means that attackers don't need any prior access to the system, and they can essentially run whatever commands they want by merely using a simple string that's parsed and processed by Log4j. It was first reported privately to Apache on November 24th, and then was patched in their version 2.15 or 2.15 of Log4j on December 9th. So for example, common ways attackers can exploit this vulnerability is by entering a specially crafted string into things like username fields, or setting it to a user agent string in their browser in the hopes that the string gets processed and executed by Log4j. The string itself generates a log message using Log4j that performs a request to an attacker-controlled infrastructure. But unfortunately for everyone, this mechanism in Log4j to perform these requests are enabled by default, which is the main crux of the problem here.
Okay, and from an attacker's perspective, I mean, I guess the importance for them is that it provides a foothold onto somebody's network. It's a way in, so to speak, is it?
Essentially, yeah. So it gives the attackers the ability to perform arbitrary code execution. And using this, they can start installing additional malware, deploying backdoors, and other kind of bits and pieces onto vulnerable systems.
Okay. And what's the impact like? I mean, you mentioned the car analogy there. Is like pretty much everybody using Log4j? Is it corporate servers, cloud? How widespread is it?
Yeah, as mentioned before, so Log4j is used by thousands, if not millions, of applications, including those by some of the biggest and well-known enterprises and applications in the world. And this essentially means that the impact of this vulnerability is huge, and was given the highest severity rating possible as well. So in like some cases, even though the applications may not use Log4j directly, libraries that applications use may include it as well. So like such as dependencies, etc. Just the applications that don't use it directly can still be vulnerable unbeknownst to the developers. And to make matters even worse, proof of concept code was also published online, which has been adopted into various mass scanning tools and has been leveraged by attackers to seek out and identify these vulnerable servers and applications. And this means that organizations around the world are now scrambling to review all of their infrastructure and all of their products and to ensure patches are applied or, where possible, remove Log4j from code bases to mitigate any possible attacks. It's essentially caused a massive headache for everyone involved.
Yeah, I mean, I know the response has been certainly one of urgency, and I've heard lots of reports of organizations working all weekend to address it. How have attackers reacted to this? What have we seen? I know you mentioned some mass scanning tools.
Yeah, so while there's been reports that suggest this exploit has been leveraged in the wild since at least December 1st, mass exploitation wasn't really observed until after the first public disclosure, like roughly 9 days later. Since then, we've observed mass scanning for the vulnerability by attackers in order to install malware onto vulnerable systems. And in these attacks, we've observed things like the MirAI botnet and related malware being installed on vulnerable systems, various coin miners like Kinsing as well, and even attackers attempting to steal AWS secrets and other kind of various Java system property information. It's also been reported that there has been active attempts to install Cobalt Strike on some vulnerable systems. And this essentially would give attackers backdoor access to steal information like usernames and passwords, and even files to deploy additional malware. We've also observed attackers adapting their exploit techniques to circumvent some of the workarounds that have been recommended by vendors while they still continue to work on patches for their products. And I suppose as this continues to play out, we're likely to see other types of malware being distributed as part of these attacks as well, including more ransomware strains with a potential focus on high value targets across a variety of sectors like banks and possibly even critical infrastructure. Already, there have been reports that the group behind the Consari ransomware family have begun leveraging this exploit.
Okay, so where are we now in terms of the timeline of danger of this? Has the danger passed now that most people have patched or should have patched? Or does it take a while for attackers to really figure out the best way to make the most of this? Or do we even know?
I suppose the short answer is no. vendors are still in the process of reviewing and developing patches for various applications affected by this vulnerability. And due to its ubiquitous nature, it's likely more vulnerable applications and services are yet to be discovered. In all likelihood, it's probably going to take a long time to establish the extent of the attack surface, and possibly even longer for these patches to be made available from all vendors. And I suppose while some attack groups have already begun to leverage the exploits to install their malware onto vulnerable systems, we're already beginning to see a shift in tactics, whereby groups are adapting to mitigations and workarounds being put in place, coming up with more creative ways to exploit the vulnerability. And it's only a matter of time before we start seeing this exploit being used by more advanced persistent groups to install backdoors and other nefarious tools that have the potential to wreak even more havoc. And I suppose in the meantime as well, I can't stress this enough, but if you haven't performed a full internal audit of all your applications and products to determine if they're using Log4j, absolutely do it now. Work with your security teams and your vendors and ensure all the patches are applied as soon as possible.
Okay, and there was another patch added to Log4j on Tuesday. What's that about? Is this related to the vulnerability?
Yeah, so it seems the patch that was released by Apache to address Log4Shell in version 2.15 was actually incomplete, and it was only partially fixed the problem. So the original patch released disabled only one part of the exploitable functionality. And in that case, it was what was known as the JNDI lookup functionality. And unfortunately, attackers were able to adapt their attacks and craft more malicious input strings that bypassed the initial fix, leading to a denial of service or DOS attack. Apache have addressed this in a new patch released on Tuesday, and this was assigned an index of a CVE-2021-45046. And in this new patch for Log4j in version 2.16, this disables all use of the JNDI support by default and removes log message lookup handling entirely to hopefully prevent any further exploitation of this vulnerability.
Okay, thanks, Alan, for coming on today. Let's turn to you, Bridget, because you wanted to talk about a blog that we published today, which is all about quite an interesting piece of ransomware that's been discovered recently.
Yeah, so as you said, Dick, we just published this blog today about a ransomware we're calling Noberus. And it was actually published about, this ransomware was published about last week by some of our colleagues at Recorded Future Malware Hunter Team 2, and they referred to this ransomware under the name ALF or Black Cat. But in our blog that we published today, we were able to share some more information about an attack chain that we observed where this ransomware was deployed in the victim organization, as well as some kind of technical details really about the operation of this ransomware. And yeah, as you said, it is an interesting ransomware because it is coded in Rust. And this is the first time we have seen a professional ransomware strain that has been used in real-world attacks actually coded in this programming language. And Noberus appears now to carry out the kind of typical double extortion ransomware attacks that we, you know, typically see these days, where they first steal information from victim networks before encrypting files. And the ransomware adds a .sykffle, S-Y-K-F-F-L-E, extension to encrypted files.
Okay, and do we know more about the, I guess, the attack chain that we've seen deploying this ransomware?
Yeah, so our researchers, they first spotted this ransomware, or this ransomware was first spotted at a victim organization on the 18th of November, so a couple of weeks ago now. And three variants of Noberus were actually deployed by the attackers over the course of the attack on this organization. So the first suspicious activity on the victim network actually occurred on the 3rd of November, so 2 weeks before Noberus was deployed, which kind of maybe gives an indication of their kind of dwell time on networks. And at that point, some suspicious network activity occurred. And then on the 18th of November, shortly before Noberus was actually kind of detonated, we saw the ConnectWise tool executed, and then Noberus was deployed a few hours after that. So that indicates that the attackers may have leveraged access to ConnectWise to deploy the payload. And while ConnectWise is a legitimate tool, we have frequently seen it being exploited by ransomware attackers in recent times to gain access to victim networks. And in fact, we saw it leveraged in, I think, the Yan Wang ransomware attack that we discussed on the last podcast as well. And of course, I suppose that kind of activity ties into a trend we've seen really over the last year and longer, probably, of attackers, and especially ransomware attackers, you know, leveraging legitimate tools in their attacks as well, for leveraging these tools for malicious purposes, obviously. But anyway, I suppose to talk a bit more maybe about the timeline of the attack. So on the 3rd of November, as we said, the first suspicious activity kind of occurred in the network. So at that point, some suspicious server message block, SMB requests occurred, on the kind of earliest machine that we saw that got infected on the victim network. And this was followed then by remote local security authority registry dumped attempts from a remote machine on the network. And this activity, it suggests that the attackers, that they may have compromised another machine on the network that perhaps we didn't have visibility on, or could also indicate that they perhaps added a new machine to the domain for which they were actually launching these attacks in order to dump credentials. And then on this same day as well, the 3rd of November, PS exec was also executed from a remote machine to launch command prompt. And then the attackers proceeded to disable a restricted remote administration feature that is known as restricted admin mode via the Windows registry. And basically this effectively disables some safeguards that guard against patch to hash attacks, which target remote desktop protocol, RDP. So basically allows attackers to then attempt to gain higher administration privileges on machines. And then the next activity occurred then on the 18th of November when PS exec was used to run multiple PowerShell commands that effectively disabled Windows Defender. Specifically, the PowerShell command was used, added a .exe to an exclusion list for antivirus scanning. And this command was then executed across the entire organization. And then later on that same day, then the first instance of the Noburst ransomware was deployed via PSExec.
Okay, and then once Noburst was deployed, what happens then?
Yeah, so once the ransomware was executed, the ransomware first deleted any available shadow copies, which is pretty typical in ransomware attacks, really, but obviously in order to stop the organization from restoring encrypted files. And it then runs commands to collect system information via WMIC in order to collect specifically universally unique identifiers, UUIDs, from each machine. And these are then used to generate an access token that makes up part of the unique Tor address that victims are instructed by the ransomware to visit in order to, you know, get back their files, basically. And an fsutil command is also executed by Noburst. And these fsutil performs tasks that are related to file allocation table and NTFS file systems. And in this incident, the attacker is specifically modifying the symlink evaluation behavior to modify the type of symbolic links that can be created on the system. Now, symbolic links, basically, they create a file in your directory that essentially acts as a shortcut to another file or folder on the system. And so this is used then to follow various types of shortcuts, which could be local shortcuts on the machine or remote shortcuts, likely to ensure that Noburst could, you know, follow all these shortcuts to perform encryption as efficiently as possible, I suppose. And as part of its propagation mechanism as well, the ransomware also attempts to mount hidden partitions, and it then attempts to spread via the netuse commands. So basically, there's embedded administrative credentials that are used as part of this mechanism, along with PSExec, which is actually embedded in a compressed form within Noburst's code. And during the attack then, the attackers were also seen modifying the maximum limit of concurrent requests that machines could make via PSExec, which was also likely done in order to aid in the propagation of the ransomware across the network. And at this point then, Noburst, it proceeds to terminate a set of predefined processes, and then it begins the encryption process, basically. Interestingly, in this case, at some point during the attack, the organization actually became aware of that something was going on, basically, and deployed remediation software. However, despite this, it appears that the attackers actually were able to return and deploy another variant of the ransomware onto other systems on the network. And in total, three variants of this ransomware were identified during this intrusion. And it led to at least 261 machines on the network becoming infected with the Noburst ransomware over the course of the attack.
Okay, and let's go back to you, Alan, for a minute, because I know you did some work analysing this ransomware. So for you, what were the most interesting parts that you spotted during your work?
Yeah, sure. As I suppose Bridget had just mentioned before, the ransomware was written in Rust, which was one of the reasons that initially drew our attention. We haven't seen many ransomware strains written in Rust language before. And as we began to dig into the analysis, there were some kind of interesting bits and pieces that popped out to us. I suppose beyond what Bridget mentioned already, one of the first things that was very interesting to us was the fact that the victim's administrative credentials were built or embedded directly into the ransomware. Essentially, there's like a JSON blob which contained this information along with a list of applications and services that the ransomware should target to terminate or kill before starting the encryption process. But some of the applications listed here were specific to the targeted organization. Additionally, the blob also included a list of files to avoid encrypting, among some other little bits and pieces that we came across. And what was interesting here is the fact that they were able to include the administration or administrative credentials and applications specific to that target organization suggests that they have been in the network for a good amount of time beforehand and have done their due diligence in mapping out the network. They had access to the entire network, and more importantly, it appears as if they had access to either a builder or potentially even the source code to embed this configuration and deploy multiple versions within the target's environment to circumvent some of the mitigation measures that were deployed by the victims. Another interesting bit that we came across was the unique identifier that Bridget had mentioned. So when the ransomware is actually executed, it obtains this UUID And this is done per machine in order to generate a unique token that's used in the Tor link. And we believe this was done specifically to stop researchers or others who may have obtained a copy of the ransomware from connecting with the attackers. Without access to the physical machine, they can't generate the same link. And it stops researchers or others dropping into the chat or spying on negotiations between the victims and the attackers.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. We know that's been a sore point with some ransomware groups in recent times. Going back to you, Bridget, you know, we talk an awful lot about ransomware on this podcast, particularly recently. How significant do you think that this new ransomware may be?
Yeah, as I say, Dick, we do talk about so much ransomware on this podcast. And I think at the early stages, it can be hard to tell, you know, the impact kind of this new ransomware can have. You know, some have a big impact and some kind of just don't kind of resonate. We don't hear about them as much after they initially appear. But however, while the reported number of victims of this ransomware so far appears to be reasonably small, the kind of sophistication of the ransomware itself and the sort of level of, I guess, determination and kind of planning and stuff that was shown by the attackers in the attack that we did observe, it does indicate that, you know, people behind it are pretty sophisticated actors. So I would say it's likely we'll see more of this in the future. And it has also been reported by, I think, Bleepy Computer and some others that the developers behind this ransomware are actively seeking affiliates on some Russian-speaking hacking forums, meaning that the number of, you know, malicious actors deploying this ransomware could potentially grow over the next while. And as you know, from what's been looked at in the ransomware, there's no apparent weaknesses in its encryption or anything, you know, meaning that unless victims have comprehensive backups, you know, they will be obliged to pay the ransom to recover their files. And as Alan said, you know, the fact that it is written in Rust is interesting as well, because, you know, it's not something we've typically seen, and it kind of shows, I guess, that the ransomware developers are maybe innovating in that kind of area of the kind of code they write their ransomware in there as well, which is also an interesting point to note, I think.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a threat that we shouldn't underestimate.
No, lots to consider there, I think. Okay, Dick, so let's turn to you then, because we did also publish some other new research this week related to APT attacks against telecoms firms. So do you want to maybe tell us what that was all about?
Yeah, it was a bit of a difficult week to publish some new research that wasn't related to Log4j or indeed ransomware. But fortunately, we got some interest from the media. What we found was a fairly wide-ranging campaign that was mostly targeting telecoms firms, but also a few IT services companies and one utility company. The majority of the targets were located in the Middle East, but we also saw some in Asia. So specifically, we saw attacks against organizations in Israel, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, Thailand, and Laos. Aside from the highly targeted nature of this campaign, I think another notable feature was that in some cases, the attackers may have been using compromised organizations as stepping stones to other victims. And furthermore, in the case of some targets, there's reason to believe that they may have been compromised solely to perform supply chain attack style or attacks on other organizations. We didn't see any custom malware being used by the attackers, and instead they seemed to rely on a mixture of legitimate tools, publicly available malware, and living off and tactics.
Okay, so that being the case then, do we have any idea who was behind these attacks?
We have some. The targeting and tactics is pretty consistent with what we would see from Iranian-backed APT groups. And indeed, we have some evidence that suggests that it was an Iranian group known as Seedworm, who are also known as Muddy Water, that was behind this campaign. Why do we think that? Well, two IP addresses were used in this campaign that have previously been linked to Seedworm activity. Seedworm, however, is known to regularly switch its infrastructure around, meaning that doesn't provide conclusive proof. However, there is also some overlap in the tools used between this campaign and earlier Seedworm campaigns. In particular, with two of the tools, Sharp Chisel and Password Dumper, The identical versions were used in this campaign and in an earlier campaign that was documented by Trend Micro. So that isn't enough to make a conclusive attribution, but it's probably enough to make a medium confidence link.
Okay, so then if this is Iran, I suppose what is the significance of these attacks? Is this the first time they targeted telecoms companies?
No, it's not the first time we've seen them target telcos. So for example, in 2018, we ourselves blogged about the Chafer Group, which is another Iranian-backed group. They had compromised a major telecom services provider in the Middle East. So what is significant about this campaign? I guess it's the sheer scale and ambition. It's multiple telecoms operators being targeted in a very short space of time.
Yeah, and you mentioned there as well that there may be a supply chain element too, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. It is quite interesting. One target that really sort of seemed to be a bit of an outlier was a utility company in Laos. It didn't, it didn't match up with the profile of any of the other targets. And what we found is that once they established themselves on that network, they then used PowerShell to try and connect to a webmail server of an organization in Thailand. And they also attempted to connect to an IT-related servers belonging to another company in Thailand. So that's the reason we think there may be a supply chain attack angle involved.
I mean, yeah, that definitely is what that sounds like. But I guess then, with that being the case, do we know what the end goal of this campaign was?
We don't know anything conclusive. Because it's frequently the case with these espionage investigations, you don't get all the pieces of the jigsaw. But I think that the targeting could allow you to make some educated guesses, such as it may be gathering intelligence about communications infrastructure in a particular country, or even trying to burrow deep enough in to actually monitor communications at that organization.
Yeah, I mean, telecoms companies are always pretty, I suppose, juicy targets for any of these kind of APT actors who are looking for potentially to gather intelligence about other people or organizations.
Yeah, indeed. I always kind of suspect that there may be a surveillance goal at the end of the campaign. Okay, so let's wrap it up there. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. If you'd like to read our latest research, including blogs on all three of the topics that we were discussing today, you can find our blog at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We are going to take a short break for the holiday period, but we're going to return once again on January the 13th. But until then, thank you and goodbye.